Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Please let the record reflect that it is 3:33 p.m. on Monday, February 28th, 2022, and also that we have a quorum present today. Our Senator Stevens, Senator Keel, and Senator Bishop, and myself, Senator Reback, staffing the committee today is my committee aide, Intimayo Harbison, LIO moderator Nate Williams, and Juliana Singh from Records. Thank you to y'all. Please silence your cell phones. On today's agenda, we have one item, a mining industry update. And today, here to present, we have Alaska's mining industry and the important work they do for the state. Karen Mathias, Executive Director, the Council of Alaska Producers, and Deantha Skibinski, Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. Thank you very much for being here today. Please put your put yourselves on the record and begin.
Thank you, Chair Reback and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Mathias. I'm the Executive Director of the Council of Alaska Producers, which is a trade association for five large metal mines and several advanced development projects in Alaska.
And I'm Wayne Hall. I'm the manager for community and public relations for Tech Alaska Red Dog Mine, for the record.
And for the record, my name is Deantha Skibinski. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Miners Association. Our association represents all aspects of the mining industry, from large-scale mines and projects, our state's coal mine, the individual small placer operations, sand and gravel, and the vendors and contractors that do business with our industry. So what we'd like to share with you guys today includes global factors, so the existing and the predicted significant increase in demand for minerals worldwide. We'll discuss our reliance on foreign sources of minerals and the policies needed to produce more minerals here at home. Truly here at home, we'll talk about why Alaska is the place that we should focus to produce the minerals we need. And we'll end by spotlighting the benefits for Alaska and Alaskans from mining in our state. So you have likely heard someone in mining say that minerals underpin everything that we do, from the airbags in our car to x-rays and medical devices to the fact you can walk into this room and turn on the light. Our way of life, as we know it, would be impossible without mining. Our dependency on mined products requires steady production of minerals worldwide. But in terms of obtaining the minerals we need, we've really just begun. The pursuit of renewable technologies and energy storage has sent, and it will continue to send, the demand surging, and subsequently the production of these minerals needs to surge as well. The World Bank, the International Energy Agency, and other entities have studied the global energy goals and are projecting a massive increase in the mineral needs moving forward. So when we look at this growing demand, we've got to think about where we're getting in from. So let's first address recycling. And yes, recycling is something we should continue to pursue, and we need to invest in technology to improve the efficacy of recycling as part of our mineral strategy. But it's still not going to be enough. Another projection from the World Bank here that even if we double recycling rates for base metals like copper and aluminum, it's not going to get us there. So an all of the above approach is really the only way to meet our needs. So knowing that we have to increase mining to meet our needs, let's ask ourselves, where do we want to mine, and where do you want mining to occur? Certainly, over the past few days, the world has watched political instability unfold. The minerals we need are currently being mined in unfriendly countries with the ability to hold our economy hostage. Currently, we're importing well over 90% of our rare earth needs from China, and the majority of the world's cobalt is being produced in the Congo with operations employing young children in poor conditions. So again, where do we want to mine? In the Congo or in a country with strong safety and environmental laws? Okay. So here you can see a quote, and we think Senator Murkowski said it best when she talked about our reliance on foreign adversaries for our critical mineral needs. We're vulnerable because of our dependence, and it does disadvantage us. And if we want to change that, we must improve our federal permitting system. Our nation's laws are among the strongest and most stringent in the world, but their implementation by the federal government has resulted in a negative impact on investment. and with no added benefit to the environment or to safety. I'd have enjoyed the opportunity to sit before this committee and made the same points in the last three administrations, perhaps longer, about the fundamental policies that are needed to grow mining in the United States. To varying degrees, these are really the building blocks of what it takes to get more mining investment in our country. And it's unfortunate that I will tell you that we've taken major steps backwards in these fundamentals in the last year. So while our current federal administration touts a desire to achieve its climate goals and acknowledges more mining has to take place, and they do say that mining should be done domestically, the administration really hasn't acted accordingly. So you can see some bullets here that talk about what the mining industry needs to produce more minerals here at home. We need access to the mineral deposits. Particularly here in Alaska, our known mineral potential in most cases is remote. With the patchwork of land ownership we have, exploring a mineral deposit on federal lands has gotten more challenging, and even working on state or private land still requires access across federal lands in most cases. So instead of multiple use management and ensuring access to these deposits, the Biden administration has instigated significant changes with land management. And a really good example of this is the recent reimposition of the roadless rule in the Tongass National Forest. There had previously been an exemption that allowed, there was an exemption to the rule to help facilitate mineral development, building hydropower projects, and other things in the Tongass that is no longer in place. We also saw a cancellation of improvements that took place to our nation's permitting process under the National Environmental Policy Act. This was created alongside our nation's environmental laws, and the NEPA process has really swelled to result in documents that are thousands of pages, have limitless topic areas, and it can really take years to pull one of these projects documents together. It's become really difficult for agencies and project proponents to manage, and even more difficult for the public to engage in. Recent attempts to make the process more thorough but more efficiently managed have been rolled back, and the previous collaboration between agencies has suffered as a result. So when you have this pendulum swing of regulatory changes and processes that lack clarity, it opens up projects and permit decisions to the risk of litigation. And I know it's fair to assume that all types of resource development in our country will encounter litigation at some point, and it's just kind of the way the world is now. But the cost of litigation and the cost of the delays that comes from litigation just hurts Alaska even more in terms of attracting investment. Our industry really believes that engaging with the public early and often has a twofold benefit. One is working with local public stakeholders really improves the proposal. And second, it demonstrates that we are working with the people in our communities and it helps to gain support for the proposals. If we want to take a look at how mining in America can be improved, I'll ask you to consider the announcements that took place last Tuesday regarding the Ambler Mining District and the road to the area. So early that morning, the White House introduced its next steps to a critical mineral strategy titled Securing a Made in America Supply Chain for Critical Minerals. It emphasized the importance of critical minerals, yet the actual details instruct the Department of Interior to evaluate the need to reform mining laws with an insinuation that domestic mining is not done responsibly. That same day, the same Department of Interior announced it had asked a federal court to vacate the permit that was obtained for the Ambler Road and to reopen the environmental analysis, alleging that there were deficiencies in the process. So this was a process that spanned three federal administrations, and it had dozens of public meetings through Alaska, particularly along the road corridor, with multiple opportunities for public comment and a very transparent process. So I know there's a lot of information, and I talked very much at length on this slide, but it really paints a picture of the magnitude of the federal administration challenges that we are dealing with. And I would like to take a moment to say to Mr. Chairman and you all, we really appreciate your efforts in pushing back on these. The state of Alaska has been sort of our bright spot in terms of defending against federal difficulties.
So Dantha covered the soaring demand for minerals to build the technologies for lower emissions and a low carbon future. We know that increasing domestic production is good for our nation's economy and security. Let's make sure that Alaska gets its fair share of investment so we can be part of the national solution while at the same time helping to grow Alaska's economy. What are Alaska's advantages? I'll start with mineral potential. The Fraser Institute Annual Global Survey of Mining Companies consistently rates Alaska in the top five jurisdictions for its pure mineral potential. We went to DNR and asked the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys for a map that would show the resources in the mineral resources in Alaska. And it turns out it's not that easy to get one map. There's so many that they're often a number of maps. So we did our best and took the one that we thought covered the minerals that we are currently producing and prospects. You can see that it's a very busy map. And that's actually a good thing because it shows how much potential there is. There are six stars on the map, if you can see them, and don't worry because they show the large mines, but I will have another map. We'll go into that in more detail a little bit later. There's also the diamonds, which are the projects. We have at least 44 active projects statewide that range from early stage exploration to advanced development. And the circles are prospects, all the places where we know we have potential. This begs the question, if Alaska has so many projects and prospects, why do we have so few mines? Alaska has challenges, our remote locations, our lack of infrastructure, the high cost of energy, all of that adds to the cost of developing mines. And right now, like every other industry, we also are experiencing labor shortages and challenges with supply chain delays. Of course, as Diantha already mentioned, there's also the unpredictability and political interference in federal permitting, which sends a negative message to investors and to companies. Even in the best of circumstances, it's still a long process to bring a mine into production. This graphic was created a couple of years ago, and in a perfect world, the feasibility and permitting periods are accurate, but recently they've been taking even longer. Fortunately, miners are tenacious, and momentum is building. As global demand for minerals increases, commodity prices should stay robust, and projects are moving forward. We are on the cusp of truly realizing our potential in Alaska. Meanwhile, our large mines have been in production for many years, and they're still going strong. They are exploring and permitting expansions so that they continue to operate in years ahead. So let's take a closer look at mining in our state. We all know that the oil industry is the industry that contributes by far the largest amount to the state revenue. But we're proud of the contribution mining makes, and it could be more if we brought even one new mine into operation. What this map really demonstrates, though, is the regional impact of mining. The red stars show our large mines, and they operate 24/7 throughout the year. Together, they had 3,000 employees and on-site contractors in the year 2020. Going from north to south, they are the Red Dog Mine, the world's largest zinc concentrate producer. It's an open pit mine on Nana land, and you'll hear more about Red Dog later in this presentation. Fort Knox is Alaska's largest producing gold mine. It's located just outside Fairbanks, so their employees are able to live in the Fairbanks North Star borough and commute to work. Pogo is an underground gold mine near Delta Junction. Pogo built and maintains a 50-mile road to access the mine from the road system. Usabeli Coal Mine is immediately adjacent to Denali National Park, and it's been in operation since 1943. The mine has been family-owned the entire time, and you have a report in front of you that provides you more details about Usabeli. In Southeast, we have two large underground mines, Kensington and Greens Creek. Greens Creek is the top silver producer in the United States, producing 30% of the domestic supply of silver. Workers at both these mines commute to work by boat. We have two projects in permitting, Donlin Gold in western Alaska and Pebble in southwest Alaska. This map also highlights our current advanced exploration projects with green circles, which are again from north to south, Upper Kobuk, which is the Ambler Mining District, northwest Alaska, Graphite Creek near Nome, Livengood near Fairbanks, Moncho in Tetlin, Palmer near Haines, and Niblack on Prince of Wales Island. Keep in mind, there are dozens more projects and deposits, some that you may have heard of, like Dawson, which is a small underground gold mine, and Bokan Mountain, which is a rare earth project, and both of those are on Prince of Wales Island. Finally, our favorite part of this map is the wide distribution of the yellow circles. Each of those circles represents one of the over 90 communities in Alaska where a mining industry employee lives. Now back to Diantha, she'll talk to us about placer mines.
Again, for the record, Diantha Skabinski, Alaska Miners Association. So here we have a look at what's commonly referred to as our seventh large mine, and that is the approximately 170 active placer mining operations across our state. This picture depicts the several different types of methods of mining that you could find at a placer mine. It's generally a small-scale method where gold is recovered from dirt using water and gravity. If I were to take you to one of these mines, or if Senator Bishop took you to his, you might get the impression that you're looking at a neighborhood construction project where earth is being moved with yellow iron equipment, very small scale in nature, small in footprint, with an average of 4 employees, although I believe the senator has less. Many of these operations are family owned and all operating seasonally when the ground isn't frozen.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I know we're going to get into, or you're there, rigorous permitting. Just go to that one.
Okay.
So, you know, we do it right here. I had a visit by the Army Corps of Engineers not too many years ago, and they were talking about, you know, I give them the nickel tour from A to Z, and the two regulators were talking about the pristine wilderness, right, and whatnot, and I said, well, that's already been mined. And they looked at each other and they looked at me and I said, no. I said, no, it's been mined. It's been mined in the last 15 years. And they could not believe the regrowth and habitat that had taken place. So I just think us, I'm going to throw myself in here, us as lawmakers, us as miners, if, you know, we could do more to tell the story on mine reclamation. And there's a representative of mine sitting in the back room there that was doing reclamation before it was ever federal law. So, sorry.
It's Senator Bishop through the chair. Please don't be sorry. Kind of want to invite you to come down here and give this presentation for me.
I'm trying to comment on that because I know we're going to get to the jobs and how important they are, but I have heard that Senator Bishop's employees are particularly difficult to get along with.
Senator Stevens, thank you for the laugh. Quickly, we are going to get into the environmental safeguards, but you're absolutely right. And Karen has some great slides on reclamation from our state's one coal mine and as well as other interior projects. I've got dozens and dozens of them from placer mines, and I have heard the same thing from the regulators that visit these operations, that this is amazing work. A lot of them have gotten awards on national stages for the work that they've done, awards from BLM and the Department of Interior. We're really proud of what our miners do here. So just hopping right into covering the environmental regime that Alaska miners work within, we maintain, and the senator made this point for me beautifully, that our mining operations and the agencies that regulate them account for what is a world-class regulatory system. Our mines are permitted for the protection of all aspects of the environment. This goes air, land, water, fish and wildlife, public health. We strive to reduce our emissions as well as our energy and water consumption by continuously seeking efficiencies and improvements in all aspects of our operations. There's strict regulatory oversight throughout the mine life from the first foot on the ground, and it doesn't end when the mine closes. There's extensive planning beforehand for the reclamation that has to take place, and there's continued oversight of the mine post-closure for the reclamation to restore the site. There's also tailored financial assurance, meaning that if for some reason the state has to step in and perform that reclamation, the money is there to cover the costs. So here's an overview of what it takes to permit a mine. This is supplied by the Department of Natural Resources, and it's very wordy, but what's here is important. The planning and the environmental study, review, testing, and the approval process to permit a mine in Alaska takes many years from start to finish. And there's dozens of local, state, and federal government agencies that are involved in the process. The permits that are listed here are what's typical for a large mine on state or privately owned land. Still, a large amount of federal authorizations required. A mine that's permitted on federally owned land has many additional permits, such as those that are under the Bureau of Land Management or the U.S. Forest Service regulations. These permits contain multiple stipulations in addition to compliance with statutes and regulations. And what this means is that the agencies can, and they do, prescribe additional practices to be performed by the mine that are outside of or in addition to the governing laws. So the main point of this slide is to show that there's no one decision to approve one single permit for a mine in our state. None of the steps within the mining permitting process guarantee approval. There's no automatic yes, no rubber stamp. Every mine's different, and it requires a tailor-made plan for environmental mitigation that is discussed and altered at length by both the agency and the project proponent before advancing to a stage forward. So again, a slide with a lot going on. This is another slide supplied by DNR, and it drills down into the state of Alaska's specific environmental management, and it provides an overview of how many agencies and departments are involved in evaluating mining proposals and what their monitoring goals are throughout. So in addition to the no automatic approval I discussed a minute ago, it's equally important to understand that continuously throughout the permitting process for a mine, there are multiple opportunities for public participation. So here you can see 13 permits where public notice for the permit is required, and there's an additional 4 where public notice is done by, as a courtesy by the state. The process is transparent, and it's designed to make sure that the public has a voice in the mining activity in our state.
For the record, Karen Mathias. So that strict oversight in permitting also continues through the operational life of the mine. Alaska has one of the best water quality monitoring systems in the world with respect to mines. It has 2 distinct parts. First, we do water quality monitoring, which is fairly standard globally, although our system may be more comprehensive than many. But in Alaska, we take a further step, which is less common in other jurisdictions, and we do biomonitoring. So our Department of Fish and Game oversees monitoring of the algae, the benthic environment, and fish, including metals uptake, habitat, and population. Alaska does more and better monitoring than most of the world, and it is a system that we can all be proud of. And then we move into reclamation and closure, and again, that strict regulatory oversight continues. The requirements for reclamation and closure are not well understood, so I want to make a few key points. First, a mine's plan for reclamation and closure must be approved by the Commissioner of Natural Resources before operations are allowed to begin. This is mandated by law. Second, in addition to approval of the reclamation plan, the mines must provide financial assurance at the outset. This is not a fund for the company's use for the reclamation work. These funds are guaranteed to the state. So if for any reason the company cannot perform the reclamation, the state can step in and they don't have to use state money to do so. Third, it does not matter where a company is headquartered or who owns the land. Financial assurance requirements apply to all companies mining in Alaska. And finally, the amount required isn't set at the outset and then just forgotten. These guarantees are reviewed every 5 years or whenever there's a significant change that requires review. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples of reclamation, and the first is from Usabelli Coal Mine. Alaska's coal mining laws require a 3-phase bonding process. Phase 1 includes backfilling and regrading to restore or approximate the original contours. This may occur within the first year of mining. But phase 2, the planting of native vegetation and establishing drainages, can take several years. Phase 3 requires successful completion of those first 2 stages, plus a minimum of 10 years after completing phase 2, plus 2 years of vegetation studies to validate that there was sufficient vegetative cover and diversity. So earning phase 3 is a multi-step process and fairly involved. When beginning to mine coal in the Poker Flats area near Denali National Park almost 40 years ago, Usabelli Coal Mine committed to restoring the land and posted a bond backing that promise. And as Senator Bishop mentioned, this was before reclamation was required. The company did it because it was the right thing to do. Last September, the Department of Natural Resources declared that Usabelli had achieved that top phase 3 status. And as you can see, we can and do develop our land to produce resources to meet the state's energy and economic needs, then restore the land to provide healthy habitat for people and wildlife. And I think Usabelli is very right to be proud of this achievement.
Oops.
Yes, thank you. I think so too. It's interesting. We oftentimes hear the opposite about how people are abusing the planet, and so I think it's really important to note again and again that they were doing this before it was the law because it was the right thing to do. So there are many miners out there, and certainly your organization, that go at great lengths. They go out of their way to take care of the environment. In many cases, leave it better than that which they found it. That's different than the ads that I've seen on TV from time to time. So very much appreciate that.
Thank you, Chair Reback. We don't actually have a lot of examples of reclamation because most of the mines that have started in the modern mining era, which the two oldest of our modern mines are Red Dog and Greens Creek, which both started operating in 1989, they're still operating. So while there is in cases reclamation that's ongoing during operations, a full closure just simply hasn't happened at most of our mines. But we do have one more example, which is True North, and which was reclaimed by Kinross, Alaska. And frankly, I can't say it better than Commissioner Feige did. And this was from October 2020 when they were recognizing the final full reclamation and closure of True North. And she said, the developers leased state land, produced a valuable commodity to serve global markets, employed Alaskans, and paid state taxes and royalties. When they were done, they remediated the effects of their work and returned the land to the state for its next use. The system works. So in that previous slide, you heard some of the benefits a mining operation can provide, creating jobs and paying state and local taxes that help fund public services. But there's so much more that can make a difference in a community, whether it's vocational training and scholarships, supporting Alaska businesses by purchasing goods and services, supporting Alaska nonprofits, or promoting a safety culture that teaches skills that get passed on at home and in our communities. Rather than give too brief an overview of all the ways that the mines and projects collaborate with different communities all over the state, we decided this year to go deeper with just one example and asked Wayne Hall from Tech Alaska to share what community partnerships look like at Red Dog.
For the record, Wayne Hall. Thank you. When I was preparing for this presentation, I just thought of something looking at the title of the slide, Benefits for Alaska and for Alaskans. And I thought, you know, I'm going to take the opportunity to say, okay, I'm going to talk about one particular Alaskan, first of all, before I go through the slides, and that's myself. My family moved here when I was very young in 1971, moved here to Juneau, a town built on mining, a town that still utilizes infrastructure from those mining days, one of the hydroelectric facilities here. And going to post-secondary and coming back with my degree in environmental science, finding opportunity as a young person in Alaska at the Greens Creek mine and now with Red Dog. And just reflecting back on that, benefited myself, my family, lots of friends here in Juneau, lots of friends and colleagues up in the Northwest Alaska. So I just thought, you know, let's put a little bit of a personal touch on it because, you know, we're talking about people here. And happy to be able to actually do a bit of bragging about the mining industry. On this next slide, I thought it'd be good just to kind of show some of the different compartmental areas of how mines produce benefits. Obviously, this is for Red Dog, lands and resources owned by Nana Resources, Nana Regional Corporation. And we're fortunate enough to have a great partnership with them and be able to mine the resource. Wanted to point out a couple of these areas of focus. One that people maybe don't think about quite often is local control. When Red Dog was proposed to be developed, the Northwest Arctic Borough was formed, and then that created an opportunity for that region to be able to make decisions for themselves, to be able to make those decisions on how to generate revenue from the mine. It also created some of that local control around schools and their school district. And in a related sense, the education opportunities that because of the mining that were helped brought into that area. So things like the Magnet School, we participate in ANSEP, GeoForce, scholarships and internships that we also have for those areas. So bringing in that opportunity for the trades, but also for those individuals that are interested in post-secondary education, give them those opportunities. Focusing a bit on some of the revenues from the mine, won't talk about all of them, but there's a couple here I would like to talk about. When you look at the proceeds that have been paid to NANA, $2.65 billion, they've shared 70% of that through the 7I and 7J sections of ANCSA, and have paid out $1.6 billion to all of the other Alaska Native corporations and most of the Alaska village corporations as well. So monies from the resource at Red Dog are reaching every corner of the state, and a lot of people don't realize that. In addition, the state of Alaska has also received significant funds over those years of $1.4 billion through corporate taxes, Alaska mining license taxing, and then, of course, the ADA facility where we ship our concentrates out through, which is a state-owned facility. Oops, I did a jump. So jumped. There was one other slide. Oh, well.
I'd just like to make a comment,
sure.
Mr. Hall. I mean, if you could just go back to one slide for a second. I think we might have inadvertently maybe glossed over it, but you look at the $318 million in 21 to the borough, and you look at the $270 million in 2021 spent on goods in Alaska and the $80 million in annual wages. We need more mining to drive our GDP and bend the curve and get it going up in Alaska, not on the trajectory we are now. So
300%.
It just shows the impact here, and we could do more of this. Thank you.
Well, specific to some of the things that we're doing with the local municipality there, the North Asartic Borough, we have two primary mechanisms where we provide funding to them. One is called a payment in lieu of taxes, which generates about 90% of the borough's revenue. And then we've also have an innovative, we call our Village Improvement Fund. And it's between $4 and $8 million, has a floor of $4 million and a ceiling of $8 million. And it's based on profits of the mine. So even in bad times, it will be no less than $4 million. There's been significant payout since that funding began. And just wanted to provide this slide here has a couple of examples. One that I'd like to point out is there's a 7-mile evacuation road that was built from Kivalina inland due to the nature of that community. It's on a spit and is eroding, so that evacuation road was built. That fund provided $1 million for that work. In addition, in a related sense, was another $3.5 million for the electrical intertie, which is also where their new school is going to be. It's the proposed new town site that's at the end of that road. So, we're talking some significant things, amounts of money here, and these are the kind of things that can also be leveraged for other grants, other opportunities, other funding. We have that seed money available. And one last thing I'd like to point out about this, we're quite proud of this program, is the decisions on how those funds are used for this kind of infrastructure is decided on by the people in those communities. They actually have a commission, and they meet and make decisions on applications from all the communities. So all 11 communities make the decision on how that funding's being used. So quite a bit different model. Talking about jobs and livelihoods, talking to some colleagues today about the difference between a job and a livelihood. Yes, we have jobs at Red Dog, but I would say we also help provide for livelihoods. We have quite a few people that enjoy working 4 months out of the year during our shipping season, and then they spend the balance of the year practicing subsistence and their subsistence lifestyle. Also, one other thing I'd like to mention, talk about that people don't think about is that we see ourselves as a stepping stone. We've had probably between 1,300 and 1,500 NANA shareholders work at the Red Dog Mine and progress into other areas within the state. And, you know, Red Dog is part of that path and them getting that on-the-job experience to then take to maybe their next opportunity. So I think that's one that needs to be talked about more. You can see the numbers there. We're quite proud of our record. We're always trying to improve our NANA shareholder numbers as much as we can. And, again, also proud of 73% of our workforce lives in Alaska. We have along the topic of education, we have an in-house apprenticeship program. You can see the trades that are listed there. And we're the first mine in North America that worked with the Department of Labor, and we have a federally recognized apprenticeship program for our mine, our mill operator apprenticeship program. So, again, these are things that these types of achievements we feel are significant. I mean, those are highly trained individuals coming out of these programs. Focusing on things that are built in Alaska, getting to your point, Senator Bishop, just a couple examples that I thought were significant that I want to bring up. We had a couple of modules that were built in the Port of Anchorage. You can see there that's the one that's being transported up to the mine with the big banner on it. That's a powerhouse module that was being transported up to the mine after landing on the shore. And then more recently, we expanded our personnel accommodations complex. All of those modules were built in a facility in Big Lake, transported to the mine, and then assembled at the mine site. Again, built in Alaska, employing Alaskans. And lastly, just a couple of examples as it pertains to state resources. We have pictured there is the DeLong Mountain Regional Transportation Port Facility, and there's also an associated road with it. That is a state asset, and I would argue it's probably one of ADA's shining stars in the work that they've done around financing that facility. And those, I believe, are still two of the largest buildings by square footage in Alaska. So that's where we store all of our concentrates all winter long, waiting for the Chukchi Sea to thaw out in spring. And then another item there is the bonding for new schools. Through the formation of the boroughs, that gives them the authority or the opportunity to tap into the bonding market and utilize bonding for construction of quite a few new schools. I think there's only, after Kivalina School is done, which is being done right now, being constructed right now, I think there's only one other school out of the 11 communities yet to be done. So thank you for the opportunity today.
I'd just like to comment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
go ahead. Go back three slides. Jobs and livelihood. Jobs and livelihoods. In-house apprenticeship.
Oops, go ahead.
Sorry, there you go.
There we go.
To do it.
Apprentices are 25% of our total trades. So by embracing that model, you don't have to work as hard looking for your workforce when you're recruiting them from day one and indoctrinating them into your model.
Absolutely.
They already know how to ride for the brand, and makes your HR person's life a lot easier.
Yeah, and
it's the right thing to do.
Absolutely. Agree 100%. And having that ready workforce in the region that really seems to want to embrace a lot of those trades, I think it's been a successful model for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask here quickly, so you provide 75% of the nation's zinc consumption, is that right?
We're out of all of the zinc producers in the United States, we produce 75% of the nation's output of zinc.
of the nation's output.
Yeah.
Is any of that used for dietary supplement? Do you happen to know?
Yeah, there is. And there's also a program through UNICEF where there's some salts and included with zinc, and the Zinc Association is involved in this. In third world countries, a lot of youth and babies die from dehydration due to diarrhea. And these hydration salts have been found through a program with UNICEF to be incredibly impactful to reducing child mortality due to some of those dehydration. So it's definitely a very small portion, of course, but yes.
Well, that's fantastic. And I have become more familiar with the benefits of zinc on the immune system, especially over the last couple of years. And so to think that a mine there in Red Dog up there in interior and up to the west could be benefiting, maybe even saving lives by building immune systems. The thought of that is pretty interesting as well. So, Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the that reclamation fund. I don't quite understand that. Where does the money come from? Where does it go? Where is it right now? And is it enough to understand it? What you're saying is that should a company go out of business, that the funds will be there for the state to use it. Can we be assured that there's enough money there to do that reclamation?
Senator Stevens, sir, the chair. This is Karen Mathias for the record. So the companies have to put up, you know, prior to operations beginning, a financial assurance. And there's a number of different financial instruments that could be used for that. Often it's you know, we refer to it as bonding. The law, when I read it, I was surprised to see that it still says you can actually put up gold. There's a number of financial instruments, but they, you know, it's like an insurance policy. And it starts before very much work has been done. It's not hard to reclaim, and then the longer it's in operation, the more work is required. But the companies also do, as they're nearing the end of mine life, they do the reclamation themselves as they go along, because they've got the equipment and the manpower there to do so. And it's always in their interest to do it themselves, because the amount that's assessed by the state and overseen by third-party audits assesses the amount of money that's required to fully reclaim the site if the state hires third-party contractors to do it. So you can imagine that for a company, doing it with their own equipment and their own people when they're there on site is going to be a much more economic way of taking care of that than to walk away, let the state take hold of that financial instrument and hire third-party contractors to do it. So each mine has its own financial assurance. It's not money that's put into a pool, although Diantha could talk about the small miners and how their reclamation is different. But for the large mines, there's a specific amount that's set aside that's updated as required so that the state could step in, take care of it with third-party contractors.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'd like to move back. I think it's slide 8, the map with the mine projects and prospects.
Sorry. This one?
Yeah, thank you. So you mentioned, you know, that there's so many prospects. Why are there so few mines? And maybe we could dive a little bit further into that. Why is that the case? Maybe more specifically from your perspective, you know, how do permitting processes fit into that? Is what can we do to help that process? What are the challenges and opportunities, maybe if you wouldn't mind?
Sure. Chair Rivak, thank you for the question. First, I'll address the part of your question as to why aren't there more. And you can see the geographic distribution of these deposits. They're in more cases than not very far away from infrastructure. They don't have a road. They perhaps don't have a port. They certainly don't have an energy source. You've probably heard us say before that if many of these deposits were in Nevada, they would already be operations because they'd be on a road system and they would be tremendously cheaper to develop. That doesn't mean we can't, and we have a lot of good models in existence. You know, Wayne could give you specifics on how the ADA funding of the DeLong Mountain Transportation System really brought that mine into reality. So what we have with ADA in terms of looking at investing in infrastructure is a good step to bringing some of these mines closer into fruition. As far as what the state of Alaska and the legislature can do to bring more of these along, really to look at ways to incentivize infrastructure and looking at ways to incentivize large companies to invest in Alaska, and looking at what can be done on the state level to encourage a company that may want to invest the significant capital that it takes to bring a mine forward. Karen showed you the timeline, but something we didn't tell you is that, you know, there are hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars that go into exploring and permitting and ultimately constructing a project. So doing things that send a message to those companies that this is a secure place to come spend that big dollar, and you will be able to, if you can meet the regulatory test that is in place with our nation's permitting system, if you can meet that, you will ultimately be able to permit and construct a mine here, are really the most important things, I think. So to summarize, the cost of infrastructure and building a mine here and providing that regulatory certainty that I'm sure you hear from all of the industries operating in Alaska, that regulatory certainty are the two biggest things that we can do to get more mines in Alaska. And please help me with anything I likely forgot.
through the chair, Karen Mathias for the record. I just want to draw attention to that the diamonds on this map are projects. So they're anywhere between early exploration and advanced development, but they're already putting in significant amount of money to determine if what they think is there is in enough quantity and at a high enough grade that it can be economically feasible to actually build a mine and invest perhaps hundreds of millions, if not actually billions of dollars. The circles are prospects. So that is where the geologists have a good indication of potential, but they haven't started to do the significant drilling that's required in order to determine what's actually there. So, you know, we really want to make sure that when people see all the circles that are prospects, that they don't assume that that could be a mine tomorrow. It is at the very, very beginning of a long process. You know, we showed the development timeline. I'll just go back to that, where they do the exploration, they do the drilling and assess it, and before they then look at, you know, a very preliminary economic assessment of could we actually build a mine, and then they continue to do more drilling, more exploration, more work, while at the same time starting those environmental studies to again get closer to being able to make that decision. Can this be done in a feasible way? So that a lot of holes are drilled that aren't going to result in a mine immediately.
Well, thank you. I very much appreciate that. And I'm not sure if the Ambler Mining District on here is a diamond or a circle, but I know that I understand they've gone through, I imagine they've spent a whole lot of money to get to the point where they're at. And we've mentioned permitting, but also access. And so, you know, it certainly upsets me to see the carpet be pulled out from under that project. And I'm wondering what kind of message that sends to the industry. I mean, I'm not sure, you know, obviously that's a federal government issue, but trying to move forward to deliver the minerals that our country needs, that the world needs. I mean, what sort of message does that send to the industry, and where are we at on that?
Wayne Hall for the record. Frustration is probably the easiest one, but I wanted to go back to your other part of your other question, which was around what's the opportunities. I think one of the opportunities here in the state is looking at those areas where we can do the permitting ourselves in-house rather than through the federal government. From firsthand knowledge and experience, when the state went through the process of getting primacy for the under the Clean Water Act for the APDS program, that had a huge effect, I know, in our operation. In the E, not The permits are still rigorous. They still have to meet all the Clean Water Act requirements. But when you're dealing with Alaskans that understand the context, that understand the land and water bodies, it just makes the process go so much smoother. And I'd encourage legislature to take a hard look at the doing the same thing, taking primacy over the wetlands program. I know it's a big program, but I think that primarily is all of the mines that at least I know we've got a project that we're looking at on state lands, and that's one of our primary hurdles is wetland permitting. So I think that is one specific key opportunity that I would recommend that the state and the legislature take a look at, and as well as funding the agencies well enough, because we need those really good people to get our permits. So making sure that they're funded appropriately. Thank you.
For the record, Deantha Skubinski, Alaska Miners Association. To add on Wayne's comment about frustration, I would be remiss if I didn't point out in particular to the Ambler Road decision, and I appreciate you saying the carpet being pulled out. I think it's even more alarming in this particular sense because when the law in NILCA was written, the access for the Ambler Mining District was specifically written into the law of ANILCA. I would imagine that for project proponents and developers to see that your law that governs and created all of the land ownership in Alaska, aside from INCSA, of course, specifically called out that we would have access through that area to get to what a known mineralized region. So that adds insult to injury, if you will, and I think it all of AMA's members, at least, were very dismayed by that decision.
I agree with that, and especially given the hostilities with Russia and Ukraine, and kind of the focus on not just critical minerals but strategic minerals, and not just that, but green energy, renewable energy infrastructure. It's been a frustrating conversation for me because I hear a push toward green energy infrastructure, which I think innovation is fantastic, but it seems like sometimes folks don't make the connection that every ounce of green energy infrastructure comes from the ground, is mined. And so I don't know, are you seeing that connection being made in your industries and your conversations with our regulatory partners? Do they seem to understand that, particularly with our federal regulatory partners, or is there a lot of work to be done?
Chair Rebeck, as I kind of hinted to in the beginning, I think the conversation, there have been conversations on the federal level where the words are said, yes, we know that it takes a huge increase in mineral production to meet our alternative energy goals and all of the technologies that are being pursued. And unfortunately, the actions are not matching the words that are being said.
How about strategic minerals? There's been a lot of talk about strategic minerals. Are we moving forward with mines in the state? I know we have pretty much every strategic mineral that the nation might need, and there's been conversations for the last couple of years. Are we moving forward to produce those? Or?
For the record, Deantha Skubinski through the chair, I'm going to get a chance to say what I really wanted to say. I was chatting, Karen and I frequently in our leadership roles at the two organizations talk about critical and strategic minerals, and I'm going to be honest with you, a year ago I didn't know what the difference was. And so I reached out to our state geologist, Steve Masterman, and I asked him, and he said, critical means that you need it, and strategic means you don't have it. So the emphasis is, see, it's interesting, right? So the emphasis being that we don't have access to a supply of those. It doesn't mean we don't have them in the ground, as this map is evidenced, but it means that we're not producing and we don't have access to it. We'd certainly like to change that. We'd certainly like to pursue all of the domestic resource of the mineral deposits of those that, but this gets back to our point. Cobalt is a strategic mineral. There are rare earths that are strategic and we don't produce them domestically.
So what particularly I know we talked about this a little bit, but specifically what are the challenges there? Is it permitting, access, both? Have we gotten close to being able to produce cobalt, and has the rug been pulled out from under us there too? What are the hurdles we need to overcome to produce those critical and strategic minerals?
And Chair Rebeck, one of the most promising cobalt deposits was in the Ambler Mining District. So
Go
backing to, back to your pulling out the carpet example.
It's like I'm living in an alternate reality sometimes, because those are the things that the nation has been begging for, to reduce our reliance on foreign countries that are trying to conquer other nations in Eastern Europe. And so it's like living in an alternate reality. I think this is really important, very, very important to talk about. It was just a gut punch to me to see them roll back, and I'm not, I just don't understand what the issue is. So maybe as much as you understand what the process is moving forward, I know this is pretty recent, so what is the process moving forward? What can we expect to see? I mean, is there any hope in the near future to produce those strategic minerals?
Chair Rebeck, yes, I think there is. I mean, I think the decision that came out, to give you a little more information, where the Department of Interior asked the court to vacate the lawsuit that was going on. It was a lawsuit brought by ENGOs against the Department of Interior. And in their announcement, the department said that we were going to go back and do more consultations with the region. We're going to relook at the environmental analysis. So if I wanted to be an optimistic person, and miners are that, I would say that, you know, they did not take it off the table. They did not veto or any of the other mechanisms. They said, we've got to go back and take another look. The delay is costly, like I mentioned earlier, and it's unfortunate because we believe that that, like I said, went through three different administrations. It was a very transparent and thorough process, but they have said that they will go back and re-engage in the process. And so I'd like to be optimistic and hope that that means that it will ultimately come to another approval.
And for the record, this is Karen Mathias, and I'd just like to caution against focusing only on critical and strategic minerals, because the problem with making lists is there's always that question of why did something get left off or why did something get put on. And one of the things that just came on this year is zinc, which we were really happy about because it is very important. But copper didn't make the list. And the reason it didn't is they say there's enough domestic supply. But if you remember at the beginning of the presentation, Diantha talked about the assessments by international organizations, the International Energy Agency, the World Bank, about how much more copper we're going to need for renewable technologies and for electrical transmission. It's a huge increase, and we need to produce more copper in this country. But just because it's not on the list, it shouldn't be ignored. We've got copper deposits in this state. Of course, Ambler is one of them. Pebble is the other, or one of the others. But it is valuable to look at all of the minerals that we are currently producing and their use and need domestically and globally, but it is also valuable to look at the ones we could be producing, whether they're on a list or not.
Thank you. Senator Stevens has a question.
Yeah, I wonder if you could reflect a little on foreign ownership of the mining in Alaska. I think it's important. I know much more about fisheries than I do about mining, but, you know, I'm very concerned about foreign ownership in the fishing industry, and I assume we should be concerned about it in the mining industry as well. You know, is there any Chinese ownership of our mining? For example, why are there so few U.S. companies involved in it? Maybe just some reflections on that.
Well, Senator Stevens, through the chair, for the record, Karen Mathias. We have six large mines. Three of them are U.S.-owned companies. And then there are two that are Canadian-owned and one that is Australian-owned. I would argue that every industry in the state has benefited from foreign investment, whether it was fishing, tourism, mining, oil, and others, often because in mining in particular, there are such huge, huge sums of money required even to do exploration, let alone to bring a mine into development, that you need to have access to a large amount of capital and also expertise. And Wayne is better situated than I am to speak to the Red Dog NANA partnership, but
that makes sense that you would reach out for a partner rather than put, you know, for the state or for Nana to put, you know, all of their investments and try to do it on their own. You reach out to somebody, to a company that's got the resources and the expertise, and you choose very selectively to find the right fit. That is, attracting foreign investment is not a bad thing for Alaska. In fact, you know, most countries and jurisdictions fight to compete to attract foreign investment. So yes, there is foreign ownership in mines, but they have brought in investment capital that then circulates within the state and allows us to produce things that we can then export and increase our gross state product and be able to import items that Alaskans want that we don't produce here, whether it's cars or food or any of the other things that come in on ships and barges and planes to our state.
But I see your point, and thank you for saying that. I guess I'm concerned now about the Russian energy being sent into Europe and the concerns that a large country like Russia or China could close that tap if we had them invested in our country. And that's my concern, is look what's happened in Europe, and it's been very hard for Germany to take a hard stance against Russia over this because they're so dependent on Russia. And I hope we will never get in that position with our mining industry.
Thank you, Senator Stevens, through the chair, for the record, Karen Mathias. I'm not aware of Russian or Chinese investments at scale in the mining industry. It's certainly not in the CAP membership, and Deantha can speak for AMA. Senator Stevens, to the chair, I'm also not of any scale, like Karen said. I'd be happy to look into it and get back to you, though.
Good to know.
Okay.
I agree with Senator Stevens. We were looking today, if I remember right, as far as mining hydrocarbons, we rely on quite a bit of oil from our Russian neighbors to the tune of $20 billion last year, I believe, which I wonder what percentage of their GDP that was. Did you have a question, Senator Bishop? Or
Jesse does.
Yeah, Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question was going to go a little less international, a little bit more interstate. I noticed the Mr. Hall's number there, 73% of Tech Alaska's employees live in Alaska, and I know that that number varies among the large mines that are operating. Certainly the high apprentice utilization is a great step. Are there other steps that the industry is looking at to try and increase the number of Alaskans working in the Alaska industry?
For the record, Wayne Hall, I can't necessarily speak to what other mines are doing. I can speak to what we're doing. Trying to be very targeted around other development opportunities. So we've talked about the apprenticeship program, but then we also have things around, we call it our accelerated development program for leadership. So selecting those people we think will have a really good potential to become young people that could have real potential to be leaders and really giving them the tools to be a leader. So instead of somebody that's a good welder, making them a supervisor, maybe that's not their skill set. So looking at somebody that's really good, we think, to be able to demonstrate some of those leadership skills, then be very focused on developing them so that they are then advancing into those supervisory opportunities. Being very targeted around where we put monies associated with bursaries, scholarships, et cetera, so that we're trying to get those youth from the region to go into those mining careers and get those post-secondary education job degrees. Quite frankly, that's probably one of our most challenging is you get a young person, you support them, getting through school. Not everybody's cut out for a rotational job at our mine, so, but they are very marketable in another place. I had a gentleman who came to work to me, Nana shareholder, great person in environmental degree, did it for a year, just wasn't his thing, which is fine, right? Again, it's a stepping stone. He now works for, I believe it's ASRC. So education, youth, developing the people that you have, and being very deliberate and purposeful. It's and we're always trying to think of new ways that we can help generate those local jobs and develop people.
For the record, Karen Mathias, Senator Keel through the chair. The other mine, each mine is different, of course, but all of the mines want to hire Alaskans and support vocational training and scholarships and programs that can give people the tools to be able to work in the mining industry. Those include the there's an underground mine training center in Delta Junction that the two mines here in Juneau use. People are hired here, go up and do their training, come back, and as well there's an underground mine, Pogo, in the interior. There's also the pathways to mining and work that the two mines here do with UAS, and there's significant support in Fairbanks for the University of Alaska Fairbanks Mine Engineering Program, as well as geology programs. So there really is a desire to reach out and provide opportunities, not just at the college graduate or college degree levels, but also at high school graduate levels. Some of the projects have the advantage of knowing that, you know, they have a number of years before they'll be making the large hiring for workers. So, for example, Donlin started reaching out to kids in middle school, because, you know, they know they're still a ways away from actually operating the mine, but if they can help provide kids in middle school with information about what kind of jobs are available, the fact that it's not just the miner, it's also the accountants, these, you know, the food service people, the human resources people, the logisticians. There are so, if you can think of a job, there's, you know, you can probably do it at a mine, because they're like a small community if they're in a remote site. So they're trying to provide that information at the earliest levels, so people can see a pathway and an opportunity at the end of it. And but of course, you know, diesel mechanics is something, we train up a lot of diesel mechanics, but they can work anywhere in Alaska. They can work in the fishing industry. They can work in the oil industry. So, you know, it's an ongoing process to try to attract Alaskans, give them the skills, and then, you know, retain them at each individual mine.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Mathias is usually an A-plus presenter, but she neglected the mines in my district contributions to the University of Alaska Southeast in her presentation, so there's a demerit there. I think if there was a question on the same topic, I'll wait for my next one.
Senator Bishop.
No, I'm going to go back to the permitting.
But interestingly enough, Mr. Chairman, if I may, that was my next question was, you had the slide in here somewhere, I'm flipping forward, about mine life. If you could talk a little bit about extending mine life and the like. I know big news, of course, from Kensington just this last week, but other mines, significant expansions and prolonging of mine operations beyond their original. Talk to us about that permitting process, about how that's going and what that portends the industry.
For the record, Wayne Hall. Maybe I can give you an example. So, right now, there's a property that, or I shouldn't say property, a mineralization about 9 or 10 miles north of Red Dog. It's on state lands, underground, so it'd be a different potential opportunity for ore. But we're hopeful that can then be the opportunity to extend the mine life from Red Dog. So getting ore from another location and processing it through the same milling facility. But similar to even permitting a mine, you still have to permit the exploration process. So we're in the middle of trying to permit a road right now and an air permit. We're going to need to do underground drilling, which would allow us to get the data we need to make a decision on whether or not it's viable or not. Right now, we can only drill in the summertime. By going underground, we can drill year-round, which will speed up the process of collecting that data we need. But there's a whole host of permits that are needed for that: housing and potable water and produced water and wetland permits, et cetera, et cetera. So even that advanced exploration project takes a significant amount of time and a significant amount of engagement and permitting to get to the phase where you can even go get the information. And then once you have it and you do make a decision, then you've got, then it's the whole process of permitting that as a source of ore for your operation. So we try to take a really long approach. So, you know, it's always, can we get that proven up and permitted before we run out of ore where we are presently? That's the hope. I don't know if that kind of helps give you an idea of kind of the processes of what we're trying to do for mine life. The other one I would mention is we're always looking at and innovations around technology and how we might be able to use that technology to help make thing ore that maybe wasn't profitable, which we would call waste rock, making it profitable, making it ore. Things like they use X-ray fluorescence mounted on a bucket of a loader to tell a loader operator when they've got ore versus waste rock. There's machines now where basically optics look at all the pieces of crushed ore and it'll actually separate the ore from the waste rock, so you get a much more richer ore that goes into your milling facility. Anyway, there's a host of things out there around technology and innovation, I think, allows us to then go back and maybe mine an area where we hadn't before and prolong the mine life. So those are probably the two areas I think I would, when it comes to trying to extend mine life.
Senator Bishop?
I'll just to touch on some earlier, just good conversation we're having here today. But back to the permitting. You look at that chart there, and 0 to 10, feasibility to permitting. I could be misspoken, and if I am, somebody correct me, but I believe from inception, initial drilling, to constructing the road at Pogo was about 10 years. So that was a pretty fast process. And then you go to Kensington, that was, I believe, 20 years in the making. So getting back to Senator Stevens's earlier question, you got to have some deep pockets, and it just shows you the magnitude, I believe, of the deposit for a company to stay in the game that long, because who's got that kind of cash flow to time value the money on the return on a project like that? And I'm hats off to them for doing that. Again, so those are two observations. You made another comment about permitting. One thing that we can do here in the legislature, and we did it last year to a degree, is all these permits are fine, but if you've got nobody in the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of DEC, Department of Fish and Game, if you don't have the workforce to execute those permits, you could be running off the dozer blade yellow. If you can't mine it, it's not going to do you any good, right? So, and we took steps last year to boost up Commissioner Feige's shop on the permitting side, I'm venting. And then you talked about 404 and wetlands. Little known fact, probably you don't know it because you wouldn't look to see it, but as long as I've been at the Senate Finance table, we've been putting allocations into DNR's budget to hopefully someday to get to the primacy with the Army Corps of Engineers on wetlands. And the last thing I'll say on that is I said it on the floor with Senator Murkowski last week, but we can't do nothing about it here, but I wish Congress would hold the Army Corps engineers' feet to the fire on the 1987 definition of what is wetlands and their new interpretation in 1994 you're all nodding your head, so you know what I'm talking about. It goes back to Anelka, no more taking, and that. And the last thing I'll say is the folks that are in the more renewable energy side of the house, and I'm one of those people, but as well, you're going to need all energy sources to move this country and the world forward. But they are finding out now how hard the permitting system is to get their projects executed. So maybe when they're complaining about how long it takes to get a permit, that maybe cooler heads can prevail. We can come together as a country and relook at our permitting process. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Other questions, comments? Comments? Going once. We really appreciate you being here today. It helps. I think this is a really important discussion. I would love to continue, but we're pushing the clock. I get the feel, like I'm sure most of you do, that some of the hurdles and hindrances have less to do with environmentalism and more to do with just halting production. And that's really the question is, what I hear and what I see from industry is refreshing, largely that we do care for the environment. We are responsible with the resources, or that's, you know, certainly the goal. But in many cases, it doesn't seem to be about that. It seems to be about stopping production. And I feel like, especially now with what's going on in the rest of the world, it's very, very dangerous position to be taking, especially when we have these resources here. So thank you very much to the committee members. Thank you to the presenters, everyone here. We appreciate you very much to come before us and talk a little bit today. Our next regularly scheduled meeting will be on this coming Wednesday, March 2nd, 2022. And this session is adjourned at 4:50 p.m.